Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Good evening. My name is David McKnight, and I'm the director of the Rare Book and Manuscript Library. This afternoon, I would like to welcome you on behalf of Mr. Carden Rogers, Vice Provost and Director of Penn Libraries, to the second lecture in this year's ASW Rosenbrack Lectures in Bibliography. Now in their 78th year, the Rosenbach Lectures are the longest continuing series of bibliographical lectures in the United States. The series began in 1931 with Christopher Morley as the first Rosenbach Fellow. Over the years, lecture topics have included 15th century printing, the relationships between print and manuscript, papermaking, book illustration, American reading and publishing, and medical and scientific texts. Among recent lecturers include Janice Radaway, Roger Chartier, Robert Darnton, Anthony Grafton, Peter Stalybras, and David D. Hall, who was here on Monday. This year we are privileged in having Michael Warner as our distinguished Rosenbach lecturer. Michael's first lecture was entitled Printing and Preaching, What is a Sermon? As it happened, when I returned home after the lecture on Monday evening, one of the local PBS stations broadcast an episode in the American Experience program, which featured a program on Amy Semple McPherson, who of course was a pioneering radio broadcast journalist and brought to mind many of the hours that I spent listening to Garner Ted Armstrong up in Canada over the 60s as his message was being broadcast from Texas. I'd just like to remind you that we do have at the back a guest book, and if you haven't signed it, please take the opportunity to do so. This evening, I have the privilege of introducing Professor Max Cavitch, Associate Professor of English in the Department of English here at Penn, who will introduce our speaker this evening. Max Cavitch joined Penn's faculty in 1999 after receiving his BA from Yale and his PhD from Rutgers. He teaches all forms and phases of American literature from the beginnings of English contact and settlement to the present day. His teaching and research interests also include gender and sexuality studies, historical poetics, and cinema. His book, American Elegy, The Poetry of Mourning from the Puritans to Whitman, was recently published by the University of Minnesota Press. He has also published essays on a variety of topics in the following journals, American Literary History, American Literature, Contemporary Psychoanalysis, Early American Literature, Screen and Victorian Poetry. He has been the recipient of fellowships from the Charlotte N. Newcomb Foundation, the Massachusetts Society of the Cincinnati, the Penn Humanities Forum, and Cornell Society for the Humanities. He is presently Associate Chair of the English Department, and he continues to serve on the advisory and executive councils of the McNeil Center for Early American Studies. Please welcome Max Cavitch.
Thank you, David. It's really fun to be here and fun to be introducing Michael Warner. Those of you who were here on Monday and heard David Hall introduce Michael that evening, heard David Hall speak of his first encounter with Michael Warner at an American Antiquarian Society seminar in the summer of 1985. While that seminar was transpiring, I was an undergraduate, a rising senior at Yale, where Michael now teaches. Like all Yale undergraduates, I was affiliated with one of its 12 residential colleges, created after the Oxbridge model, but named, most of them, for American political and religious worthies, such as Timothy Dwight, John C. Calhoun, and the namesake of my college, Jonathan Edwards, who features prominently in Michael's Rosenbach lectures this week. I was an English major at Yale, which really meant something at the time. Which is to say, it meant that you could earn a bachelor's degree in English without ever being asked to read anything written by an American author. Not Timothy Dwight, not John C. Calhoun, not even Jonathan Edwards. This was a travesty for many reasons. For one thing, on Yale's faculty at the time, in one department or another, were R.W.B. Lewis, Alan Trachtenberg, Richard Broadhead, Brian Wolfe, John Butler, John Demos, and Harry Stout. And Yale was also, then as now, the home of formidable collections of early American manuscripts, books, and other printed matter, the epicenter of the study of both Jonathan Edwards and Benjamin Franklin. I really don't know how I missed all that. But Michael isn't missing any of it. Indeed, Yale's Edwards and Franklin archives were among the shiniest lures it could possibly have dangled before him to persuade him to leave Rutgers after almost two decades. Shortly after Michael started at Yale, which was about 2 years ago, I remember him radiating delight as he told me what it meant to him to be working in the Edwards papers. His exact words were, "I feel just like a pig in mud." This is proverbial, of course. As St. Peter observes in his second epistle, where he chastises those who have known the ways of righteousness but turned against them. He writes, St. Peter writes, "It has happened unto them according to the true proverb, the dog is turned to his own vomit again, and the sow that was washed to her wallowing in the mire." This is a passage that Jonathan Edwards himself remembered in constructing a personal narrative of his own religiosity, where he says of his youthful backsliding that he returned like a dog to his vomit and went on in the ways of sin. Edwards doesn't include the part about the sow and the mire, presumably because he feels that the vomit-scarfing dog is the more repulsive and therefore more effective image. If you've seen a dog do this, you might well agree. But if you know dogs, then you know that in this behavior, there are complex evolutionary, behavioral, and aesthetic factors at play. And if you know dogs or pigs, then you also know that the alterity of their pleasures is anything but sinful, though it may be more than a little queer. Pig and dog remind us, if we should ever fail to remind one another, that there are pleasures from mud wallowing to coprophagia and beyond, unpredicted by our philosophies, or that are judged narrowly and harshly by them in an effort to forestall certain rifts or shifts or gifts. Now, I would love to hear St. Peter, Jonathan Edwards, and Michael Warner discuss the phenomenology of pleasure. Ben Franklin could moderate. But if we can't have that, we do have Michael. This week, in propria persona, and always in his writings, his books and articles on American literature, social theory, history of the book, the ethics of marriage, sexuality studies, religion, queer politics, secularism, nationalism, new media, and yes, erotic vomiting. These writings are among the most graceful, as well as the most exigent in the humanities today. Taken as a whole, Michael's work is, among other things, a sophisticated disquisition on pleasure. And this should come as no surprise, for Michael is not only one of the smartest people I know, he's also, perhaps paradoxically, one of the happiest. The life of ideas is a life of joy for him, and that joy is not only the powerful engine of his scholarship and his modus vivendi, it's also the source of the contact high one gets whenever one reads or listens to him. So let's welcome Michael back for his second lecture.
I sure wish I had a muckier paper after that introduction, but I'm afraid it's a little theological, in fact, tonight. Thank you, Max. That was really sweet. Benjamin Franklin and Jonathan Edwards make such a convenient pairing that I'm a bit embarrassed to be doing it once again, because almost every introductory lecture survey in American literature does this. Often to show the divergence of the emotionally charged revivalist from the secular rationalist, the man who speaks of nothing but sin and the man who speaks of nothing but errata. Because of the imaginary power of this contrast, Franklin's involvement in evangelicalism has required some explanation. George Marston calls it one of the striking paradoxes of American history and exclaims with surprise that Franklin was better friends with Whitfield than Edwards was. But there are historical reasons for thinking that evangelicalism and enlightenment are distracting reifications developed much later. And unlearning the opposition might enable a more critical examination of the history by which the supposed polarity of religion and the secular has come to be a regulatory framework in modern culture, embedding late Protestant assumptions about the nature of religiosity and the free subject in secular governance and religious cultures alike. Without the retrospective confidence that evangelicalism and enlightenment must be at odds, we might find that what now seem to us grand antagonists occupied very similar space in the media culture of the 1720s and 30s. And by attending to that culture, I think we'll find that the framework of secular religion, or evangelical secularism, rests centrally on conceptions of circulating discourse and the kinds of subject who participate in public media. Let me clarify that I'm not arguing that the revivals led to the public sphere or vice versa. Both Edwards and Franklin were young men whose rhetorical projects began with perceptions of new circulating media, news, controversy, ephemera, criticism. They differed on key details of how to imagine the individual's use of these forms, but it is not necessary to see the difference as one of separate realms, the secular political public sphere versus the religious world of supernaturalism and devotion. They occupied the same genres and the same conceptions of discourse, time, and the social. Both required the space of controversy afforded by competing printers, the compressed and progressive temporality of news, awareness of translocal fields of circulation, and a semiotic ideology of uptake. Maybe I should read that sentence again, because that's actually my roadmap through this paper. So let me repeat those four things. Both required the space of controversy afforded by competing printers, the compressed and progressive temporality of news, awareness of translocal fields of circulation, and a semiotic ideology of uptake. In today's lecture, I will try to trace each of these in Edwards, as well as to remind us of the theological environment of Franklin's thought. I will suggest that there are important connections among news, newspapers, and revival, that the relation between belief and uptake was a principal crux on both sides, that the language of free thought served as a common provocation, that both reimagined the social in terms of circulatory space and time, and that both, sometimes at least, imagined surprisingly impersonal grounds of public speech and uptake. Finally, I will turn to one area on which both had conflicting or ambivalent views, the ethical space of public speech and scandal. There are some strong parallels between the two men, some familiar and some not so familiar. It is well known that they were of the same generation, born 3 years apart, grew up in the Reformed faith, in the same region. Both were early and voracious readers of many of the same texts, including The Spectator, theological disputes, including polemics over deism, the periodical culture of the Republic of Letters, including Shaftesbury and Collins. Both made their careers with anonymous print publication. But what is less often emphasized is that Edwards was a print controversialist and Franklin wrote theological argument. Edwards himself linked the first awakenings in the 1730s to the controversy or great noise over Arminianism that he was then busily involved in. the Hampshire Association, a clerical consociation of which he was a member, had moved to block the appointment of one Robert Breck to a local pulpit, citing his alleged Arminianism, which is a kind of catch-all category for anything that Calvinists don't like. As the conflict escalated, they even for a while arrested Breck and charged him with atheism and blasphemy under a Massachusetts statute. So I think, as I mentioned on Monday, one of the things I'm interested in here, and this will come back in the paper, is the gap between the norms of public space that make sense out of charges of blasphemy and ideas of free circulation in which that seems just like a ridiculous idea. With Breck in custody, his supporters called a meeting in front of the townhouse for speeches, and a print war raged as far away as Boston. Edwards wrote one of the tracts in that affair, which is called A Letter to the Author. Wait, let's see if I can get this going. There we go. This one. And so even before the revivals were underway, he was already a print controversialist. Throughout the revival period, his activities as promoter and publicist were unstinting. The Faithful Narrative, to take the best known example, was circulated in a long and complex process. First as a 1735 letter to Benjamin Coleman. The letter was then circulated by manuscript around Boston and across the Atlantic. John Guys, who received it in London, incorporated it into a sermon. It was Guise's congregation that first requested the publication. Then, after a complex relaying of messages across the Atlantic, Edwards wrote a longer account in response to the request. Coleman abridged that, appended it to two sermons by William Williams that were going through the press during the Breck affair in 1736, and then sent the publication with a letter back to Isaac Watts and John Guise, who decided to print the longer version in 1737, where it was read by both Whitfield and Wesley. I hope I lost you in all that. The point is just that evangelicalism is completely enmeshed from the very first moment in these very complicated networks of publicity and news. And from the very first conversion that Edwards reports in the Faithful Narrative, it's already being packaged as news for that pathway. When he describes the first conversion of the first young woman, he says the news of this spread throughout the town like lightning. Later tracts, including the Distinguishing Marks, went through several editions. This is one published by Franklin himself. This tract began as a sermon at Yale and was then printed in an expanded edition in Boston. Isaac Watts published one in London. John Wesley printed an abridgment that itself went through many editions. Now, let me illustrate the importance of these relays among preaching, news, and print with the opening sentence of Some Thoughts Concerning the Present Revival of Religion in New England. This is a work from 1742 in which Edwards is theorizing the nature of preaching and responses to preaching at the middle of the greatest crisis in the revival episode. He begins by confronting an apparent discrepancy between the public sphere norms of print discourse and the authoritarian discourse of clergymen. The question is which one of these is exemplified in his own treatise. In the ensuing treatise, I condemn ministers assuming or taking too much upon them and appearing as though they supposed that they were the persons to whom it especially belonged to dictate, direct, and determine. But perhaps shall be thought to be very guilty of it myself. And some, when they read this treatise, may be ready to say that I condemn this in others that I may have the monopoly of it. Obviously, his target here is old light critics of the revival. It is they, and not ministers in general, who have presumed too much. But Edwards does not say it that way. He condemns the discourse norms of monological authority, ministers assuming or taking too much upon them and appearing as though they supposed they were the persons to whom it especially belonged to dictate, direct, and determine. Now, this is an unfamiliar stance in which to find the man who did so much to prop up clerical authority that his own congregation would depose him for excessive zeal in that endeavor only 8 years later. Here he anticipates that the complaint of authoritarianism will be lodged against him in turn. In parrying the complaint, he goes on to give a classic expression of the public sphere norms that he associates with print. You can see this quotation begins at the very bottom of that page. In a free nation, such liberty of the press is allowed that every author takes leave without offense, freely to speak his opinion concerning the management of public affairs and the duty of the legislature and those that are at the head of the administration, though vastly his superiors. And lest you think that that's merely a political norm, he goes on to apply it to the revivals and the disputes over religious norms. Private persons may speak their minds without arrogance. Notice that Edwards here worries about the ethics of status in speech. Who can speak without arrogance to those who are vastly his superiors? Later in the same work, he asks the same question specifically about preaching, that is, who's authorized to preach in mixed company and so on. I'll return to this issue of status because I think it's very important. I don't think it's merely tactical that Edwards begins the treatise in this way. It is, to some degree, clearly tactical. The contrasting images he gives of discursive legitimacy are, to some degree, merely political. Old lights presume to dictate. I merely offer my opinion. The difference is also partly generic. One can assume a liberty in a treatise that hearers of sermons do not have. Writers often adopt a different posture of authority in printed controversy than they do elsewhere. But for whatever reasons, Edwards here registers as an inescapable fact the changing environment of public discourse in general, and he comes remarkably close to undermining the model of authoritative discourse of which preaching is the sacred instance. As he well knew, there was a powerful movement in his own day toward imagining a form of religiosity totally consistent with the idea that private persons may speak their minds without arrogance, and that was called free thought. Free thought is largely distinct from deism, though historians tend to treat one as a screen for the other, just as they tend to treat deists as hypocritical atheists, and to treat the whole issue as though it were just about doctrinal belief. There's never been the book on the phenomenon of free thought that should be written. One of the targets I have in mind here is a book, a semi-popular book that came out a few years ago, right after 9/11, actually, called Free Thinkers by Susan Jacoby, that purported to be a history of American secularism. But its way of doing a history of American secularism was just to trace the famous American statesmen who were influenced by free thought, as though it were a belief system. And my argument here will be that the real issue with free thought is what counts as belief and why. This is emphasized both in Shaftesbury's characteristics and in Collins's discourse concerning free thinking. Here, let's see. Yes, I'm beginning section two. The subjects of which men are denied the right to think by the enemies of free thinking are of all others those of which men have not only a right to think, but of which they are obliged in duty to think. Videlicet, such as the nature and attributes of the eternal being of God, or of the truth and authority of books esteemed sacred, and of the sense and meaning of those books, or, in one word, of religious questions. The passage illustrates four points about free thought relevant to the context of Edwards's career. First, the sense of obligation that Collins appeals to here clearly derives from the Christian function of salvation. It is because of something existentially urgent at stake in discourse that one must be able to think freely. Otherwise, it would be mere opinion, and no argument is made here about why any opinion whatsoever must be allowed. It is only opinion in matters of saving belief or saving knowledge that need to be specially protected. Second, however, it is opinion. Collins appeals to a very mental conception of religious truth in weighing different truth claims. It's essentially, as I'll make clear a little later, it's essentially a propositional model of religion. Third, Collins makes it clear as he continues that the key condition for an individual search of religious truth is the availability of different circulating propositions. Individuals have in themselves limited resources of judgment, But truth consists in those views that ultimately survive criticism. So the only way to arrive at religious truth is to make sure that the maximum number of propositions circulate. And finally, there is an authenticity criterion. Only those views that are well considered and deliberately embraced will have saving force. Collins continues, "For if they will not think for themselves, it remains only for them to take the opinions they have imbibed from their grandmothers, mothers, or priests." I leave it to you to reflect on that list of examples, or owe to such like accident for granted. In other words, if you don't have a detached and reflective consideration of the beliefs before you have your saving attachment to them, then they are mere tradition and doesn't have any saving force at all. This last point is one made by evangelical Protestants themselves all the time, and Edward stresses it in several early sermons. If you consider yourself Christian only because you were born into a Christian society, you are only outwardly Christian. Your belief is not saving belief. So, the delegitimation of Christian society is a result of an intensified personal demand for conversion. This is the sort of dialectic that has been stressed recently by Charles Taylor in A Secular Age and by Marcel Gauchet and others. It is in the reformist, purifying turn toward a higher standard of authentic faith and genuine salvation that we see, paradoxically, the modern assumptions of secular freedom first laid out. Collins artfully points out that a critical break with traditional religion is presupposed by evangelism itself. For how can the Society for Propagating the Gospel in Foreign Parts, he writes, hope to have any effect on infidel nations without first acquainting them that it is their duty to think freely both on the notions of God and religion which they have received from their ancestors, or which are established by law among them, and on those new notions of God and religion brought to them by the missionaries. Franklin made all these arguments as well. It is striking that he did so not as a secularist, acting to contain religion. He did it in the mode of theological controversy, employing religious arguments. One example is a dialogue between two Presbyterians that appeared in the Pennsylvania Gazette in April of 1735. But tell me, one of the partners says, if the Presbyterians in this country, being charitably inclined, should send a missionary into Turkey to propagate the gospel, would it not be unreasonable in the Turks to prohibit his preaching? So polemicist after polemicist points out that missionizing, in fact, raises the need for something other than traditional repetition and social uniformity in religion. Naturally, when Edwards uses some language like this in some thoughts, he doesn't mean to delegitimate clerical authority or preaching in general, nor to elevate, in the manner of free thought, the superior truth value of impersonal circulating discourse. That he takes up language with this evident tendency is an indication of the deep challenge facing him in the treatise. Some thoughts concerning the present revival of religion is an attempt to theorize the norms and understandings of preaching, then undergoing a profound adjustment to public sphere forms. Sermons were in circulation in a transatlantic circuit in which they mingled with a deist theology that was largely about circulation. In Edwards's language, we see some overlay of these different footings. I'll return to some thoughts to discuss its views on what legitimates public speech. For the moment, I want to notice that this is not the first time that Edwards appeared in a public sphere controversy, nor the first time that he invoked the norms of public dispute in religious discourse. He had been doing so all along. In 1723, after going to New York, fresh from Yale, Edwards wrote a shorthand set of rules for himself preparing for fame in print. The world will expect more modesty because of my circumstances, in America, young, etc. Mankind are by nature proud and exceeding envious, and ever jealous of such upstarts, and it exceedingly irritates and affronts them to see them appear in print. Like Franklin, he started life with wide ambitions connected to print, and some forethought about how to manage the distrust of others through a show of humility. Edwards also tells us in the personal narrative that during the period he spent in New York, this is the fall of 1722 and the spring of 1723, he had great longings for the advancement of Christ's kingdom in the world. I used to be earnest to read public newsletters, mainly for that end, to see if I could not find some news favorable to the interest of religion in the world. Now, I've noticed that my students sometimes think that this is a narrow or parochial or even perverse way to approach newspapers. But actually, I think the point that I've come around to in this paper is that it's a modern assumption that newspapers are necessarily a secular space. I think I was trying to show that last time. The interpenetration of sermon discourse and theology and newspapers is really very striking in the period. What's odd about Edwards' story about reading newspapers in New York in 1722 and 23, and that seems to have received no comment in the scholarship, is that Edwards could not have been reading the New York newspapers. There were none. Bradford's Gazette did not begin for another 2 years. New York was a commercial seaport, however, that might have brought stray newspapers from anywhere. But a young New Englander would have been likely to seek out the Boston papers, and to one who had recently come to the city from Yale, then at the epicenter of an enormous controversy over it's called the Great Apostasy, over the defection of its rector and several other tutors to Anglicanism. To one who had recently come to the city from Yale, concerned for religious news in the wake of the Great Apostasy, he would have found interest in a paper such as this one from October of 17. Oops, I got my slides out of order. This one from October of 1722. I'm sorry for the poor quality of the slide, but here is what you're looking at. This is, of course, Silence Do Good, number 14, written by the 16-year-old Benjamin Franklin at a time when the 19-year-old Edwards was fresh from the scene of the crisis. I want to point out two key emphases in this passage. The first is the assimilation of religiosity to opinion. This is in the opening line. In matters of religion, he that alters his opinion on a religious account must certainly go through much reading, hear many arguments on both sides, and undergo many struggles in his conscience before he can come to a full resolution. I think you can see many of the same assumptions that I was illustrating in Collins, the idea that religious belief is essentially propositional, but that it has a more than merely opinionistic force because it has to be saving knowledge. The first is the assimilation of religiosity to opinion, and particularly to the formation of opinion by reading. As with Collins, the idea appears as an extension of the Protestant value on true religion and saving knowledge. The second half of the passage is about the public arena of moral discipline. Beliefs, it turns out here, are not just private because they are lived out in view of others, and because the moral fabric of the social is therefore at stake. The first idea appeared far and wide in the 18th century, been deployed by Collins as well as by Locke, centrally in the letter concerning toleration. And even John Wesley took it up for a while. As he wrote to his mother while a tutor at Oxford, faith is a species of belief, and belief is defined as an assent to a proposition upon rational grounds. Without rational grounds, there is therefore no belief and consequently no faith. We think of this as a kind of rationalist view of what it means to change one's mind or to have a religious belief, but in fact it has an enormous religious history in the 18th century. It's picked up not only by people like Wesley, but by a guy named Glass, who founded a whole sect called the Glassites, continued by Robert Sandeman. The sect eventually became known as the Sandemanians. Sandeman moved to America, had many followers here. The last great Sandemanian, by the way, was Henry James Sr. So it has a long afterlife in American thought. The Sandemanianism and Glassism is basically the belief that because religious faith is nothing but assent to propositions, there is no need for conversion because it can't have, if it is just assent to propositions, it can't have that transformative conversionistic effect that Christians are looking for in conversion. So they become kind of universalists. Edwards, like Wesley, clearly felt the pull of this view, for much of his thought is a struggle to articulate a radically different and more exigent conception of uptake. Now, the great thing about the propositional view is that it's a simple view of what keeps discourse moving through the world and how an individual takes up a text. Edwards argued throughout his life for a more exigent conception rooted in affect and in forms of agency over which the individual has no control. So the famous example in Divine and Supernatural Light is illustrated through the sense of beauty. Edwards argues there that if I have an idea of a man, if I have an idea of the beauty of a man, I don't know the beauty in the way that I do when I have a sense perception of the beauty of that man. So Edwards is concerned from the beginning of his career through the Treatise on Religious Affections and the late works with distinguishing between the existential mode of saving knowledge and the kind of propositional knowledge that was everywhere being articulated around him. Franklin, by contrast, does hold a strongly propositional idea of uptake. This is one of his theological tracts. It's a letter to a friend in the country. It's written during a controversy. And at the same time that Edwards is involved in the Breck affair, Franklin is involved in an almost exactly parallel controversy called the Hemphill affair. Both of these are controversies about the legitimate ordination of ministers who were suspected of Arminianism at a time when the Westminster Creed was being enforced both in Western Massachusetts and in Pennsylvania. Both ministers had expressed a propositional view of what belief is. Both were suspended by the Hampshire Association in Massachusetts, by the Synod in Pennsylvania. Both defended themselves in print and were attacked in print. And Edwards took part in one affair and Franklin in the other, and exactly the same years. And this is one of four works that Franklin wrote as part of the Hemphill affair. And it goes, am I on my right quote? I think I'm quoting a different passage here. For as long as men are made by God himself of different constitutions, capacities, geniuses, etc., and since in his all-wise providence, he affords them very different, very various opportunities of education, instruction, and example, a difference in opinion is inevitable. Besides, a man's sentiments are not in his own power. Conviction is the necessary result or effect of proof and evidence, and where the proof does not appear sufficient, a man cannot believe or assent to the supposed truth of any proposition if he would. That is, it's not a purely voluntary or agential thing. In this context, it is easier to see that both free thought and the evangelical move in the Reformed tradition were ways of connecting saving knowledge to public controversy. Freethinkers thought that circulation was a necessary condition of authentic belief. In a different way, so did the evangelicals. Again, this is a point that could be illustrated with a Franklin remark, where he writes, this is what I'm thinking, here we go. It is sufficiently known to all the thinking part of mankind how difficult it is to alter opinions long and universally received. The prejudices of education, custom, and example are generally very strong. It may therefore seem in a manner needless to publish anything contrary to such long imbibed and generally received opinions. It were, however, much to be wished that men would consider how glorious a conquest they make when they shake off all manner of prejudice and bring themselves to think freely, fairly, and honestly. This is obviously both a view about what constitutes individual salvation and a justification for a circulating medium. The salvational stakes are a key in both cases. In Edwards, they lead him to break with some of his own deepest commitments to clerical authority in order to argue that potentially anyone can and should have access to public speech. At a later moment in Some Thoughts Concerning the Present Revival of Religion in New England, he offers an extensive thought experiment that shows just how far this question reached. It appears in a discussion of lay exhorting. Oops, that's more Franklin. Here we go. This is a topic, he notes, about which there has been abundance of disputing, jangling, and contention. Edwards embraces, as he had done in a related passage of Part 3, the ideal of lay people both exuberantly conversing and exhorting one another. The question then becomes how to tell the difference between talking, which anyone can do, and preaching, which distinguishes clerical office. The two ways of teaching and exhorting, the one of which ought ordinarily to be left to ministers and the other which may and ought to be practiced by the people, may be expressed by those two names of preaching and exhorting in a way of Christian conversation. But then a great deal of difficulty and controversy arises to determine what is preaching and what is Christian conversation. Edwards first asserts that the distinction is about authority. The common people, in exhorting one another, ought not to clothe themselves with the like authority with that which is proper for ministers. But what does that mean? Does the repeated metaphor of clothing oneself in authority mean that it is a stylistic or rhetorical device? What determines its legitimacy? In answer, Edwards appeals to the standard ministerial ideology. Ministers speak not in propria persona, but as the ambassadors or messengers of Christ, speaking in Christ's stead and as having a message from him. A constantly reiterated theme in clerical rhetoric, especially in ordination sermons. Edwards clearly doesn't think that this solves the problem either, because he goes on to imagine a number of ambiguous situations, including some where ordinary people, even to his evident surprise, women, can legitimately speak in the presence of their superiors and expect solemn attention. I think this is where we are here, in the middle of the left page. If something very extraordinary happens to persons, or if they are in extraordinary circumstances, as if a person be struck with lightning in the midst of great company, or if he lies a-dying, it appears to none any violation of modesty for him to speak freely. You see, public speech doesn't come easily for Edwards. Before those that are much his superiors, I have seen some women and children in such circumstances on religious accounts, that it has appeared to me no more transgressing the laws of humility and modesty for them to speak freely, let who will be present, than if they were dying. Edwards' whole treatise is attentive in this way to gradations of station, office, gender, generation, and rank. Because he attributes a divine rightness to norms of modesty and deference, it takes special, extraordinary circumstances to justify a socially indiscriminate address. Let who will be present. I'm going to call this a disembedded address. It's something that we take completely for granted, but only came about in the 18th century as a result of a great deal of stress. The matter of the gospel clearly counts for Edwards as such an extraordinary circumstance of existential urgency, like dying, so that it is no more a transgressing the laws of humility and modesty. The personal exigency of speaking paradoxically legitimates a socially unmarked address. Obviously, we have the same result as that propositional mode of assent that all the free thinkers were invoking, but the logic is quite different. The logic of this passage would seem to be authorizing a priesthood of all believers in a way that would deprive ministers of a special right to preach. In order to forestall that kind of Quakerish inference, Edwards goes on to sketch out a kind of ethnography of the preaching situation, listing a whole series of details about the situation that might determine whether it's this kind of exigency or a kind of pretense to social authority. I will actually skip this because I want to get on to the next point. In order to understand the importance of these questions for Edwards, one must remember that, as George Marsden puts it, all his instincts were hierarchical. Moreover, these instincts were not just about command and authority and rank, but about the norms of common space and speech. This was the world in which his own Yale College strictly regulated the space of the college and the norms of interaction by a finely graded sense of rank. When a freshman, this is the official regulations now, when a freshman is near a gate or door belonging to college or college yard, he shall look around and observe whether any of his superiors are coming to the same. And if any are coming within 3 rods, he shall not enter without a signal to proceed. All undergraduates were to be uncovered and forbidden to wear their hats, unless in stormy weather, in the front dooryard of the president or professor's house, within 10 rods of the person of the president, 8 rods of the professor, and 5 rods of a tutor. There are additional measurements for how freshmen are supposed to respond to sophomores, juniors, and seniors, and so on. Everyone has a spatial distance. This regulation illustrates beautifully, I think, what is a general truth before the 18th century, which is that social space is never empty space. It's always filled up with considerations of status and rank in this way. Similar rules of status govern not only who spoke in public, but where they sat. In 1737, the gallery of the old Northampton Meeting House gave way and collapsed during a service. So it was decided to build a new one. The new building, which is this one, the third meeting house, was built in a fashionable classical style with a steeple. The steeple, of course, iconically marks the building as a church. But in New England, most of the towns had insisted on a single meeting house for civic and religious affairs. As Cotton Mather pointed out, meeting house was the preferred term in New England. They didn't call it going to church. They called it going to meeting. And as far as I can tell, no one has written the history by which, I see I have lots of good dissertation ideas in today's talk. No one has written the history by which the northern colonies began to separate the spaces of meeting by building secular town halls in parallel to the meeting houses, which eventually became known as churches. But we do know when that happened in Northampton, immediately upon the completion of this new building. No longer would Edwards preach in the same room as the town meetings. The town built a separate structure. At the same time, as Marsden points out, this probably felt like the dawn of, less like the dawn of a new secularism than like a return to an old English model. The new building required, however, a revision of the seating chart. And this, I apologize for the low quality of the image, but the pulpit is up there at top center, and these are family boxes around the side. In the family boxes, the different sexes could sit together by family. In the middle floor, you have women on one side and men on the other side. In addition to grading everybody by family position and sex, the choice seats are also reserved for the people of greatest wealth. And after wealth, standing in public and civic affairs is also taken into consideration as a third criterion. But wealth clearly counts higher. So a very complicated calculus of social standing went into who was sitting where in the Northampton Meeting House. That's the context in which Edwards produces this view of a socially disembedded address. In this context, a move to legitimate lay exhorting and public speech by women, far from being a primordial orality, as it has sometimes been interpreted, was in fact a new conception of spoken address that required extraordinary circumstances to legitimate its disembedding. And there are many indications that the new forms of conversionistic address, although they eroded older forms of script mediation and delivery, deepened the involvement in Atlantic ambits of circulation. Now, I can illustrate some of this with the one text I think everyone knows by Edwards, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. Historians often complain that Edwards is so often known by this sermon, because historians of Edwards tend to be cheerleaders for Edwards, and they fear that their idol will be typecast as a fire and brimstone preacher. So they routinely claim that this sermon is atypical, and in some ways that's true. Though I think the tradition of what's called evangelical humiliation, it's a term of art in New England preaching, is beautifully represented here. The sermon is certainly unusual in its marketing, however, because although it is not an occasional sermon, it was printed by itself, it's unclear how this came about actually, and reprinted frequently for the rest of the century. No other colonial sermon had so many standalone reprintings, and very few non-occasional sermons were printed in this way at all. If you were here on Monday, you remember I emphasized that sermon publication in 18th century America was almost entirely a non-capitalist or extra-capitalist endeavor. This is one of the rare exceptions, or seems to be. Like many printed sermons, it gives the date of its preaching, preached at Enfield, July 8, 1741. But why does it say that? July 8th was neither the first nor the last time that Edwards preached this sermon. It was first preached at Northampton in June, in that new meeting house I just showed you, and then at Enfield in July, then a third time at an unknown location with a different scripture text as its point of departure, and probably several more times, since there exists a skeletal two-page outline in the Edwards papers at Yale that probably served as pulpit notes once Edwards was familiar enough with the trajectory of the sermon that he could get by with bare notes. Edwards always preached with some kind of text in front of him. He never felt comfortable with extemporizing. The title page names Enfield probably because this was the only time that the sermon is known to have triggered much reaction. The description of that event in the diary of Stephen Williams, a neighboring pastor and relative of Edwards, is famous. Before the sermon was done, there was a great moaning and crying out throughout the whole house. What shall I do to be saved? Oh, I'm going to hell. Oh, what shall I do for a Christ, etc., etc., so that the minister was obliged to desist. Shrieks and cries were piercing and amazing. After some time of waiting, the congregation were still, so that a prayer was made by Mr. Williams, and after that we descended from the pulpit and discoursed with the people. The power of God was seen and several souls hopefully wrought upon that night, and oh, the cheerfulness and pleasantness of their countenances that received comfort. Oh, that God would strengthen and confirm, etc. We sung a hymn and prayed and dispersed the assembly. Well, one thing we learn from this record is that at Enfield, Edwards never finished the sermon. Shorthand notes on the manuscript suggested he only got as far as the first use in the application. So the title page is by modern standards wrong. The text we have was not preached on July 8th. And the printed text differs substantially from the manuscript, as the editors of the Yale edition point out. Edwards, they note, restructured the entire application to make it one long use in the printed version, changing it from its mild pastoral tone to a much more dramatic, intense form. In fact, the last several pages of the printed text bear very little resemblance to anything in the manuscript. There's a reference to Lot that occurs, but well before the end. What Edwards added for publication includes, paradoxically enough, all the vivid description of the moment of delivery for which the sermon is best known. This is the beginning of the application. At the beginning of the application, Edwards, or his printer, italicizes the word there. Let's see if I can find this.
There
how does it go? There is the dreadful pit of the glowing flames of wrath of God. There is hell's wide gaping mouth open. So these are deictic gestures, presumably are inviting us to imagine the preacher pointing to metaphysical hell gaping in the physical floor of the Enfield meeting house. At the end, these ostensive gestures, imitating the deictics of the meeting house in which they were apparently never performed, multiply on the page. There is reason to think that there are many in this congregation now hearing this discourse that will actually be the subjects of this very misery to all eternity. We know not who they are or in what seats they sit. Obviously, we're not in the Northampton meeting house, or we would know it. One imagines the congregants peeking about and severally asking themselves, is it I? But alas, instead of one, he continues, how many is it likely will remember this discourse in hell? And it would be a wonder if some that are not now present, Edward says, should be in hell in a very short time, before this year is out. And it would be no wonder if some person that now sits here, oops, no, I'll get to that in a second. And it would be no wonder if some person that now sits here in some seat of this meeting house. These lines, so vivid in their evocation of the scene of preaching, were penned for the press. There is no trace of them in the manuscript or the outline notes. It would be tempting to conclude from this, simply that Edwards considered oral delivery primary and tried to replicate it. In fact, that does seem to be the standard interpretation. But the continuation suggests rather that Edwards has specifically in mind a conversionistic scheme that is more at home in the circulatory space of news. And now you have an extraordinary opportunity, a day wherein Christ has flung the door of mercy wide open and stands in the door calling and crying with a loud voice to poor sinners, a day wherein many are flocking to him. In other words, and theologically this becomes very complicated here, in other words, your conversion is easier to hope for because it would be simultaneous with that of many others who are geographically proximate. And notice that there's even a footnote here. He says down at the bottom of the page, how can you rest one moment in such a condition? Are not your souls as precious as the souls of the people at Suffield, the next neighbor town? Now, on one hand, this strange idea requires a Calvinistic theory of grace and special dispensations. Simultaneity in this moment of opportunity could only theoretically matter if God is doling out a special dispensation of grace enabling conversion. It couldn't be a result of the rhetoric of the sermon itself because a persuasionist appeal can only be a means of grace and not a promise of redemption. On the other hand, Edwards unmistakably appeals to the mimetic desire of aggregation and acceleration. Many are daily coming from the east, west. I assume that north and south are in train here. Wait. Many are daily coming from the east, west, north, and south. Are not your souls as precious as the souls of the people at Suffield where they are flocking from day to day to Christ? And then the penultimate paragraph finally discloses that there is a millennial scenario behind this idea of contemporaneity and proximity. What the simultaneity and acceleration of revival suggest is that the millennium has begun in Hampshire County, Massachusetts. God seems now to be hastily gathering in his elect in all parts of the land, and probably the bigger part of adult persons that ever shall be saved will be brought in now in a little time. At this point in the sermon, we get the obsession with geography, compressed temporality, and numerical demography that are the classic hallmarks of modern evangelicalism. I think it's the mark of the media environment of circulation. Because here I think Edwards is thinking about his print audience and the possible efficacy of the circulation of the text in the sphere of news. Because of his millennial expectations, Edwards was able to see the simultaneity of private persons and the linear unfolding of public news as providentially coordinated and as signs of something miraculous. Thus, the acephalous and impersonal character of public discourse could be valued by him for completely different reasons than by Franklin and Collins. And the forward acceleration of secular time indicated responsibility for the future, but not because of faith in coordinated human agency, quite the opposite. No wonder that in the mid-1740s, as the revival and its millenarian expectations were spluttering, Edwards's version of evangelicalism encountered a crisis. Somewhat desperate, he turned to the idea of a concert of prayer. Oops, sorry, I'm behind in my slides. Oh, here I have, this is just to illustrate the unusual printing history of sermons, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. Unlike any other sermon I know, it goes through multiple re-editions, six, I think, in the 18th century, and each of them has interesting differences in the publication history. This one's printed for a bookseller who's got an odd profile in the trade. This one's called the third edition. It's actually the fifth because there were a couple of others not by that printer. Here we have the Concert of Prayer. The Concert of Prayer was an attempt to get mass numbers of people around the Atlantic, not just in the colonies, but in Scotland and in the Caribbean as well, to agree on certain times at which everybody would pray simultaneously. This might seem like an odd idea, and Edwards acknowledges it in the pamphlet when he entertains objections. One of the objections he entertains is the commonsensical one, Some may be ready to say there seems to be something whimsical in its being insisted on that God's people in different times and different places, should put up their prayers for this mercy at the same time, as though their prayers would be more forcible on that account, and as if God would not be so likely to hear prayers offered up by many if they happened not to pray at the same time as he would be if he heard them all at the same moment. Well, what's the answer to that? Why is it important to coordinate mass numbers of people to pray punctually and simultaneously? Edward's answer is, this seems to be a proper expedient for the promoting and maintaining an union among Christians of distant places in extraordinary prayer for such a mercy. In other words, it's a union for the promoting of union. I think we couldn't possibly have arrived at this idea. Edwards was not the only person who arrived at it. Actually, it was first trotted out by some Scottish ministers a couple of years earlier. But we couldn't have arrived at this idea without already having the social imaginary of disembedded circulation combined with the idea of moral space. Now, a curious detail in Franklin's autobiography might be relevant here in thinking about the nature of that moral space for which this union of unions was necessary. It's when he's explaining why he wanted to leave Boston. He says, my indiscreet disputations about religion began to make me pointed at with horror by good people as an infidel or an atheist. This, too, is a constant strain through the 18th century of the experience of scandal and horror about the possibility, the notional possibility, that there might be an Arminian, there might be a deist, there might be a freethinker, there might be even, well, maybe it's theoretically possible that there's an atheist presently roaming the land. This experience of being shamed or shunned or pointed at, being the object of scandal, is a resonant theme in Franklin, and much of his thought and practice as a writer are designed to avoid it, including a consistent avoidance of publishing under his own name. But the flip side of this is that the norm of scandal is not just ignorance or bias. It has a moral scheme of its own that in recent years has had to be excavated by much critical work on religious resistance to secular and liberal governance by thinkers such as Talal Asad, Saba Mahmood, Bill Connolly, and so on. What these thinkers have emphasized is that in cultures not already regimented by liberal ideas of free circulation and freely standing individuals, public space is routinely thought of as having a moral cast and as working on the formation of moral subjects from outside in rather than expressively from inside out, so that exclusion of forbidden possibilities is necessary to the maintenance of moral goodness for individuals as well as for public orders, that stigma, horror, shame, and scandal are necessary components of a moral society. Jonathan Edwards voiced this norm consistently throughout his career. In an early sermon, Sin and Wickedness Bring Calamity and Misery on a People, for example, he argues that moral behavior and speech are not hidden and cannot be regarded as publicly neutral, because they are stumbling blocks to others. Stumbling blocks is the always handy term for this. And here I quote from the application. I think I have a slide. Oops, no, I don't. Sorry. Well, we'll just kill that. The application goes, we hence learn what cause we have to lament the prevalency of sin and wickedness in our nation. As we are part of the nation, or of the same body politic, we ought to look upon ourselves as concerned in their guilt and their calamity. If the nation is subject to calamities and is brought low, our interest is so much embarked with theirs that we shall feel it as a member feels the disease of the head. We ought therefore greatly to lament the wickedness of the nation. It is this notion of the moral saturation of public space that most constrains the new ideas of circulation in the 18th century. Free thought and individual judgment were one thing, but public speech was also a mode of moral display. It had effects. Edwards asserts in the same sermon that it is free thought that is weakening the sense of the publicness of moral conduct. In the latter times of the nation, there has arisen a new sect of infidels that call themselves free thinkers, that cast off all religion and despise the restraints of it. They deny the gospel, ridicule the story about Jesus Christ, and so on. This has grown fashionable in all the nations. They glory in it that they have courage enough to cast off the restraint of revelations, and that they dare enjoy their pleasures and give themselves their liberty without being frightened at the threatenings of eternal damnations. As is so often the case with conflicts over the moral inflection of public speech, the telling example in this sermon turns out to be sexual. And this sermon is preached in the moment of the early revivals when there had recently been a controversy over circulation of pornographic text, what then counted as pornographic text, which is Aristotle's masterpiece and a medical text, for prurient reasons among the youth of the town. So Edwards goes on to say, young people take more and more of a licentious liberty in their keeping company. We might think pornography is a really interesting subject in this context, if you think about that as an imagination of uptake, so to speak. How bold and daring. 'Tis amazing to consider that such things have got such head, that they are so impudent in their impurities. And there is not that discountenance of such things as there formerly used to be. It is not now such a discredit, 'tis not accounted such a blot and disgrace to a person. Formerly, things were accounted such a wound as a person could never get over as long as he lived. That be not such much minded anymore. Now they are so bold and impudent that they are not ashamed to hold up their heads. Without some sense of the moral work of scandal, shame, and public disapprobation, it will be hard to understand why the new sense of freely circulating discourse entailed so much struggle on both sides. For although it is tempting to think of the evasive, privatizing Franklin as completely exempt from this concern, remember that his art of virtue is very much predicated on the idea of moral behavior as public and mimetic. Franklin, too, had his unions for the promotion of union. And again, the Silence Duguid paper that I cited earlier, remember, ends with that long passage about the nature of moral space and the necessity of people to match their private convictions with that theater of public imitation. But print, for him, was a way of thinking about the moral significance of circulating discourse as neutral, a scene of private judgment that could have no direct public effects of its own, and is perhaps only a book that, in debauching him from his work, was seldom snug and gave no scandal. Thank you.
We have time for questions, so please, yes.
Yeah. You mentioned that Franklin communicated more with Whitefield than Edwards himself. So can you give some examples of Franklin's communication?
Well, Whitefield stayed in his house. They were friends. They corresponded, and Franklin published tons of Whitefield in the early 40s. In fact, I think there's a table. Is it in Peter and Jim's book? Do you have the table about the Whitefield imprints? Or maybe it's Miller's great bibliography of Franklin's Philadelphia printing. Is that where it is? That you can see the number of imprints that Franklin's putting out for a year, and then he gets to Whitefield and suddenly shoots way up. So Whitefield made Franklin's business, and Franklin helped make Whitefield's publicity. It was an alliance of great mutual convenience, at least that's the way it's usually represented in the histories. But what I'm trying to suggest is it's much more than that. I actually think that that because of Franklin's interest in this kind of public mimetic nature of moral speech, he really wanted to promote Whitefield. He began promoting Whitefield. He sent an invitation to Whitefield when he first heard that Whitefield was coming to America. So it clearly worked out well for his balance book, but I think that there are lots of entanglements that Franklin has with theological argument, with the nature of religious thought from the beginning of his career that made him see Whitefield as a natural ally. And they apparently got along very, very well. Whereas when Edwards met Whitefield, they had somewhat tense and nervous interactions.
Other question? Yes, Liliana.
Thank you very much for this wonderful presentation. space, and with the example of the Yale regulations and so on. And it struck me that there is this close relationship between the oral and the print, and the development of full space in relationship to print culture. Could you say more?
I'm sorry, the development of what kind of space?
Of full space in relationship to print culture.
Because orality
is working with less of a distance, so to say, to be heard, whereas print can circulate wider. So the question of space is obviously changing at that time. So how does full space lead to that kind of print culture?
I actually don't think it works quite that way, because first of all, there is so much interplay between and this is what I was talking about on Monday. There is so much interplay between forms of print and forms of public speech, different genres of print, different public genres of speech, that I don't think you can make any rigorous distinction in this period, in this society. The concept of orality, those of you here on Monday, bear with me a second. I do think this bears repeating. The concept of orality is one that has a number of pitfalls embedded in it. The primary orality is a much disputed concept among anthropologists to refer to societies without writing. Secondary orality is, again, a much disputed concept to describe the lives of people not yet affected by structures of script in an early script society. But Walter Ong never used, and for good reason, never used the word orality in this third sense, which is so popular these days, which is to refer to any spoken context, even in a heavily script-saturated society like colonial New England. Anytime you've got a state society, everyone is affected by script. Everyone is affected by clerical ideology. Everyone is affected by the social imaginary structured around literacy. So I think in modern societies, it makes no sense whatsoever to speak of orality as a thing. I don't think there's any quality or condition that underlies, as a common denominator, all conditions of spoken discourse, about which we can say much more than that they're all spoken. And so I think the concept of orality misleads people into making these kinds of generalizations that I think can actually be shown to be false, because we have lots of forms of print that are themselves oriented to filled up space. And certify status and so on. It's only when print is recognized as defined by the field of circulation that you get this idea of empty space through which print moves. And that's the thing that I argue is a very modern development. Similarly, once that develops, you can have contexts of speech that appeal to the same idea of the social. So Amy Semple McPherson, take a good example. She's a good example of a lot of things in my project, and one of them is how evangelicals are often at the forefront of media culture. And she, not only the radio station, but also, you know, she had all kinds of stage spectaculars in the revival. She had motorcycles come wheel around auditoriums and tableau vivant illustrating various theological ideas, and dancing girls. That practice illustrates her assumption that what she's doing is, and I think you can see this partially in Edwards, much more in Whitfield, much, much more in the 1790s, what she thinks she's doing is addressing a circulating field of strangers who are brought together in relation to her speech by no other set of conditions. It's an ad hoc assembly. It's people who've only come to hear her speak. And that is the same picture of the field of circulation that we have in these modern forms of print media. Whereas you can also get printed texts that, you know, that come from a different conception of public speech. Yes? Katie!
Hi, Katie. I'm having listened to your speech, I'm being convinced by it. I'm curious now why not Whitfield? Because it strikes me, you remarked briefly that Edwards historians love Edwards, and I'm sure you could speak for a really long time on that, but my own observation would be is either that they're evangelicals hoping to resuscitate Edward at the center of evangelicals,
yes,
or they're secularists, hope, well, subscribe or not, hoping to remind us that religiosity could look in a certain way verified by brilliant minds. And I was struck by seems to be a much more useful trans-historical figure, who feeds into the evangelicals, and the most evangelical historians want the debunk. They don't want the world that feels as one the way it has within evangelical circles. So I guess I'm interested in what use Edwards were using, because it strikes me slightly a red herring in the category of evangelical. And so maybe it talks about why for you, speaking of Edwards and evangelicalism is important.
Well, you know, I'm reconsidering this, actually. I had a good talk with David Hall about this yesterday, about trying to distinguish the features of the social imaginary and the way the field of circulation is being picked out that I think are common between Edwards and Whitfield and later evangelicals. It actually doesn't mean that I should use the term evangelicals for Edwards, because to some degree that imports some later assumptions. And I take that objection to heart, and I want to try to pare that language out a bit, because what I'm really trying to suggest is that in the early period, especially in the 20s and 30s, especially in the 30s, it's very difficult, if not impossible, to tell where what we now recognize as evangelicalism and what we now recognize as the Enlightenment meet, or where they're separate. They're inhabiting what we now call these two grand, you know, movements, are inhabiting the same space and working out a lot of the same perceptions and assumptions. So I'm really trying to narrow the space between our understanding of Franklin in this period and our understanding of Edwards in this period. And the trouble with labels like evangelicalism, I think you're quite right, is that it tempts us to think that there's a teleology necessarily linking Edwards and even Whitfield to the 19th century forms of evangelicalism, in which someone like Robert Baird can celebrate the evangelical scheme as the triumph of the voluntary system and the real meaning of disestablishment. Of course, I am also trying to figure out why disestablishment by the end of the 18th century could seem like an evangelical cause, right? So.
It strikes me that the disembedded versus the conversionist might be one of your ways of working with Whitfield, separating out Whitfield and Edwards.
Thank you. Yes.
There's so many suggestive threads that are running through these lectures so far, and I just was wondering if you worked on rhetoric of modesty in relation to these.
I'm sorry, rhetoric.
The rhetoric or the rhetorical, have made a rhetorical analysis of the concepts of modesty and humility with respect to the self, salvation, secularism. It just seems that in this space of printed speech, of sermonic delivery, of exhortation, and of fear and trembling, there's a lot of movement here with respect to the self. And I'm just wondering, when people are invoking the seemingly simplistic, cliche concept of modesty, do you sense that something more is going on here? Do you see changes in the different ways it's expressed in language and print, in sermons?
Well, that's a huge question. Modesty means a lot of different things in this case. And because one of the things that's at stake is how much are you exposed personally in public speech? Are you speaking in a role, or are you speaking in a kind of abstract, impersonal function? Can you step outside of your moral self in order to utter an opinion publicly, and so on? That gap between moral self and public self is the thing that everyone's worried about in these quotations that I'm using. So that does entail various problems of rhetoric in the traditional sense of self-presentation. I think it also entails problems of rhetoric in the more, in a sense it would be a little harder to explain without a lot of theoretical background, that you could take it in a Domainian direction or a kind of Silversteinian metapragmatic direction. There are other concepts of rhetoric at play that I think are more interesting to me, that have to do with how the situation of speech itself is glossed by the content of the speech. Now, that's something that would take me a while to explain. So maybe I should leave it for another occasion. David.
I'm completely convinced by your account of Franklin's continued engagement with and closeness to religious discourses and appeals. And I'm wondering yet what to do with how artful Franklin is at those moments when he others religious folks and religious discourses.
Yes.
So, do you see a change over time? Do you see a retrospective? Do we overquote the autobiography in which he seems to create more distance than there is in the 30s and 40s? Is there a change that happens?
I think so. If you think about the Hemphill affair, the way he describes that in the autobiography, you'd think that it's only about Plagius. But it's obviously not. He wrote four long works on, three of them are longish, with dense theological arguments, and I think he cared. I mean, I think he liked going to church when Hempel was preaching. He liked the idea of that kind of moral space. He was deeply exercised by the Presbyterians with whom he was disagreeing, although he also printed one of the papers from the other side. So there again, he was acting as printer, not just as theologian. But there's no sign in the autobiography of what was really on his mind in that controversy. And he makes it a kind of joke in the autobiography. And as he does with Whitfield, he makes his giving money at the collection moment after Whitfield's address a kind of a cute little joke about the emotional appeal of the address. But he doesn't explain what I would really like to know, which is what motivated him to give that invitation to Whitfield in the first place.
Is this a sign, if I can rephrase my question,
yeah.
Is this a sign that something's changed between the 1730s and 40s and
the
70s? Or is it Franklin doing the same thing vis-a-vis religion and everything else, constantly spinning it so as to evade accusations of being indiscreet or accusations of being secular or...
Well, that's a good question. I'd love to know what your take on that is. There are several things that intervene that are clearly relevant, and one of them is that episode in the 1760s in London where he's drawn, I forget all the details, he's drawn into a sort of deist attempt to create a natural religion liturgy. Do you remember anything about this? There's a guy in... I'm forgetting the whole story here, but just about the time Franklin was leaving London, he got drawn into an attempt to create a public ritual around free thought, which is the one thing that free thought didn't have, because the way free thought is usually explained, its only ritual is the reading and printing of theological argument. So there was an attempt, because someone figured out that this was putting free thinkers at something of a disadvantage compared to Whitfield. There was an attempt to create some pageantry and show and structure. Later on, this is repeated over and over. The American free thinking societies of the early 18th century always set up halls of science, is what they're called, to offer weekly Sabbath contemplation of the beauties of nature and edifying lectures and so on. Can't imagine why it didn't work. And I think in that case, and in several other cases, I think Franklin felt somewhat burned by his entanglement with fringe figures that cost him status or with possibilities of public culture that he didn't quite support. You remember, this is the way he explains the repudiation of his early free thinking in the autobiography, that he is in fact worried about that moral space question. There might be stories like that to tell. I don't know. This is what I turn to you for.
I think we have time for two questions. So one and one back.
Yeah, Matt.
Wonderful thoughts, Michael. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the nature of non-topical publishing and its effect on conversionist address or uptake. You know, the revival saw a resurgence of the publishing of the 17th century evangelical manuals, manuals of piety, something that Charles Anders Stowe has written about. And yet they're not, you know, they don't have this sort of topical urgency that interests you. So, there's some on it, right? They're not necessarily sermons.
No, they aren't. I mean, I talked a little bit about Baxter's Call last time, And I do think that to a large degree, those older texts were able, people were able to recognize them within the new norms. And so I think there's a bit of retrospective misrecognition of what's going on in Baxter and Allen and some of the other classics that are always being reprinted, you know, well into the 19th century by the American Tract Society. The American Tract Society was obviously very far from Baxter at that point, and yet they keep reprinting the call in mass numbers. So yes, there is a lot to be said about the coexistence. Again, I don't need to be telling one of these stories that goes, you know, once we had pre-modern forms of piety and devotion, and then newspapers came along, and then it's different for everybody. The interesting story is even within the careers of these two characters, you can see a lot of push and pull between different conceptions of religiosity and different conceptions of public discourse. So I don't need to be telling a story in which those things disappear. They don't. They get reanimated, paradoxically, by the new ideas of diffusionistic space. So when people begin to think of public space as this kind of empty field for the circulation of a conversionistic address among strangers, that's, you know, the way I understand this later model of evangelicalism, they are able to see the printing of thousands of copies of Baxter's Call as modeling that. And so they send out Baxter's Call to the hinterlands by the truckload, because they've got this idea of what they're doing in a field of unknown strangers, and with the desire to missionize, with the desire of domestic missionization. Now, again, that doesn't make sense in Baxter's more Calvinistic framework. So clearly some different idea of the motives and functions of publication is at play there, even though it's the same text.
Yeah. I was really interested in your term disembedded speech, and I wanted to ask you whether you think that empiricism has a version of the justification for speech, which is that it's disembedded, where, for example, someone who is not educated in the sciences can observe a natural fact and write in about it.
Yeah.
In fact, lightning is one thing that gets written about under that rhetorical justification. So I guess what I'm wondering is that when you see sort of this enlightenment fact lining up with this, you know, evangelical fact, what do you do? I mean, do you say then these are actually instances of the same kind of rhetoric, or do you say, no, this is separate context, they just arrived at the same place? I guess I'm wondering what you think it's legitimate to say about that type of,
you
know what I mean?
I'm beginning to think that we should methodically distrust our sense of separate spaces. And to take your example, the classic study of this is Adrian Johns's book that shows that culture of science, culture of the book, make each other. It's not as though you've got print culture and then it unfolds its norms in the world of empirical science, or even exactly the other way around. It's that what we now recognize as print culture is partly formed by specifically scientific uses of print, and what we now know as science is partly used by print-based modes of science. And Johns shows this in great and subtle detail. And I think that you could do something similar with the frameworks that I'm looking at here.
Thank you very much, Michael. Thank you very much for coming. This time tomorrow at 5:30, we will have the final installment of this year's Rosenbach Lectures. The title of Michael's lecture is Evangelical Publics and Christian Nationalism in the Late 18th Century.
I set you up.
Quick update here.
It's called the Evangelical Black Atlantic, Phyllis Wheatley and John Morant.
Thank you. See you tomorrow.